accession number 28528, Reel 12.
My troop is on the banks of the Po. There is blood on all our tank tracks. We have many prisoners. Our progress in the support company had been unbelievably smooth, and our other companies did not have a much tougher time. While my brother Philip and I ended together in Austria and were always close, neither of us discussed the other's war. Shortly before his 83rd birthday was due, I read a book on the 8th Army's victories, which included frequent complaints by Rommel about the terrible effect of our artillery. I thought it how odd it was not to have discussed his war from France before Dunkirk to Alamein to Greece to Klagenfurt, and was now set to do so after the birthday party. Sadly, he died a few days before, but at least Sir James Wilson's book gave me some insight, as in this incident on the way to the Po. A rifle company of Germans advanced across the open ground the other side of the Panaro. We watched them fascinated. They clearly had no idea we held the Bondano Bridge, far less that we were sitting in houses completely dominating their position. I gave orders no one was to fire until ordered, and 0 hour for doing so was approximately 15 minutes away. That gave time for Philip Pawson to get the services of 104 Royal Horse Artillery complete and an extra battery of 12 RHA for good measure. Ralph Stuart Wilson had time to prepare a full quota of mortar bombs. Our first burst of fire was devastating. Philip and Ralph had coordinated the respective flight times of guns and mortar shell to perfection, so that at least 100 projectiles of various calibres arrived on target simultaneously. Whenever the enemy moved for the next 2 hours, Ralph and Philip opened up piteously. The Germans occasionally tried to get Spandaus firing at us, only for Philip or Ralph to be onto them immediately. The Germans could only endure a couple of hours before there came a mass blast of whistles as they broke and fled in disorder. I had never seen them disintegrate like this before. This was for me not just a glimpse of Philip in action, but a good indication why our artillery was so superior in its flexibility, speed, and accuracy. Once across the Po, we surged on with first Udine, then Klagenfurt in Austria, our objectives. What the going was like, I described in this letter home of April the 24th. Things are really moving fast here, and the whole German army south of the Po, and moving fast here, and the whole German army south of the Po, and most of it is south of the Po, are likely to be taken prisoner. We are told that there is nearly 500,000 of them, but they seem to have lost the fighting spirit for which they deservedly were once noted. Our encircling sweep in the Lombardy plain looks like cutting off most of them, as our 6th Armoured and 2 American Armoured divisions are sweeping aside all in their path, and it can't be long before nearly all of them are in the bag. The speed and certainty of our tank and motorised infantry advance has meant very little work for my support company of mortars, machine guns and anti-tank guns. On one occasion, I put a 6-pounder anti-tank gun on a road, though we did not really expect any tanks to come down it. To my surprise, an anti-tank battalion then put a 17-pounder anti-tank gun with massive camouflage on the other side of the road. The camouflage was necessary because, of course, that particular gun sticks out so far. A German tank did, however, come slowly down the road, probably having got lost. Both guns fired together, with the tank and the 17-pounder gun going up in flames. There was no real harm to the gun, as it was the extensive camouflage nets that the flash from the gun had ignited. It was, however, fortunate we destroyed the tank first shot, because the 17-pounder was temporarily out of action, and we would both have been very obvious. So far, it has been a rather brilliant battle for us to be so dominant, once they have no heavily fortified lines and natural barriers of rivers and mountains, which have given them such exceptional defensive advantages in the past. Our division and the rest of 10RB have done really well, taking masses of prisoners. I haven't seen Brother Philip again. Things have been so fluid you can't go looking for anyone, as you are likely to get lost or sniped at, so it's not worth it. Support company has been rarely required for action, so we have had an easy and relatively pleasant time moving up from farmhouse to farmhouse and being welcomed for the night and well fed. Our objectives, the German surrender in Italy was complete by 2nd of May, several days before the overall surrender in Europe. On the night of the surrender, all was joy unconfined, with fireworks lighting the air, but not for everyone. One of our officers stood at the back of his jeep, blocking the taillight. That cost him his legs, and another vehicle crashed into it. As I was driving into a town, a drunken priest on a cycle swerved into the car so suddenly my driver could not avoid him, and he became concussed as he fell off. Not much cause for joy then as we took him to hospital. Indeed, there was still an unpleasant twist or two to the war. Next night, near Udine, we parked in a hospital ground, sleeping in our vehicles. In the morning, as we were washing and shaving, wearing braces and open-necked shirts, a rifleman dashed up to James Booth and myself to say that a shouting band of partisans was about to execute a Cossack, and his two pals were arguing with them. We knew of the Cossack's appalling record of cruelty to the Italian civilians, but James immediately ordered me to take three riflemen and take over the Cossack, a bedraggled and shambling man continually repeating that he was a Christian. Our confrontation with the partisans turned nasty, as they were determined to extract their revenge for the crimes committed. They were egged on by a virago of a woman pointing a submachine gun at us. It only needed some excited idiot to pull a trigger and we would have been shooting each other. But they finally calmed down and left spitting curses at me and the cowering Cossack. So emotional was the incident for me that I included it in an article for Blackwood. This was my first for the magazine and also described the chaos as the war came to its conclusion. Every few miles we passed droves of prisoners shambling down the roads or herded together in utter confusion in the fields. As British tanks and trucks fell merrily along, between them dark lorries covered with the red, white and green flags of Italy, and packed tears deep with youthful partisans, strangely armed and garbed. On the verges of the road stand little parties of soldiers, and along the sides moves a slow river of people trudging back to their houses, often in rags or without shoes or socks, many bowed down by huge backpacks and bulging suitcases. Many try to thumb lifts from trucks which never stop. If you go on further past a litter of burnt-out trucks, you find the last dying embers of the battle. You come at last to that area which always seems the same. Their life and movement suddenly cease, and the desolation and silence are broken only by the sudden whip of bullets or crash of shells. That we experienced in the streets of Spoleto, needing tank assistance to fight our way through. When the Germans did at last surrender there, they were very apologetic when told that the armistice had already been declared and they were out of order in continuing to fight. They claimed they had never heard of it, but we wondered whether perhaps they wanted, in their anger at losing the war, to have a last go at us. Looking at the ordinary civilians as they struggled along, I reflected that these were the people who always pay. The people who have come to terms with life are always being uprooted by those who can't. In victory's wake, the partisans are already inflicting their own terror. Summary justice sounds fine in theory. Face to face in the flesh, it is disgusting in its stark crudity and absurdity. Hate and passion still rule the day here, not common sense and compassion. When are these hatreds and killings and pilferings going to cease? When are men going to stop trying to put their own blame on the shoulders of others? Meanwhile, from a long-suffering world, where might still masquerades as right, the cry goes up, how long, O Lord, how long? Another for the Glasgow Herald described the even more emotive scenes as we travelled on to Klagenfurt. All along Italy, the military police had signed our route, when appropriate, with the mailed fist symbol of the division. On the boundary, however, it expressed our joyous feeling, with the fist this time having its thumb up. The scene in Austria, however, was chaotic and confusing. Crowds of people were on the move every which way. Some were civilians shambling back to homes. Many were soldiers in a variety of uniforms. Some were Tito partisans on a purposeful march, armed and aiming to annex what they could in Carinthia, while some roads were lined with dejected Germans sitting at the side waiting to be captured. I had no time to stop, as I had been ordered ahead to commandeer billets for the company on the outskirts of Klagenfurt. James Booth, following on behind, did pick up a head chef and head waiter of the prestigious Adlon Hotel in peacetime in Berlin. Whether they had been or not, they were certainly expert at their jobs, and we kept them on our company strength for some months. Back at Tidworth years before, we had a padre who was very keen on his food. He always surveyed the menu before saying grace. If it looked an average meal, the grace in flat terms was, for what we're about to be thankful, may the Lord make us truly thankful. For what we're about to receive, may the Lord make us truly thankful. However, if it appealed to him, the grace in exultant terms was, O bountiful provider. With our expert caterers, that would have been a constant recurring theme. The best padre, I recall, was with us in North Africa. He admitted to being scared witless, but would still do his job under fire. After the Kasserine battle, he confided to me, why am I so frightened of death when I ought to look forward to it? Clearly, he was not religious suicide bomber material. My writing for the Glasgow Herald and magazines had an odd beginning. Brother Philip's guns were part of the small force sent to prevent civil war in Greece as the Germans withdrew. The communists had been waiting to seize power with their ELAS movement, trying to overthrow by force the government the Allies supported. This was the worst and most difficult type of war, with the enemy often in civilian clothes and difficult to identify until too late. Philip had been something of a Greek scholar at Winchester College, and to that extent was amused to have his guns defending the Acropolis. Less amusing was his being the only person seen running naked across this famous building as mortar shells unexpectedly ended the shower he was taking. The initial tiny force sent to Greece was a parachute brigade, a squadron of tanks, and Philip's battery of 25-pounder field guns. They had to face over 20,000 communist guerrillas, often disguised as civilians, always well armed. The Germans had equipped them in return for a guarantee of unopposed passage by them as they retreated. They had also won further supplies by overrunning the Athens police stations and had shown their power by capturing the main Athens aerodrome, Tatoi, and taking prisoner a large number of RAF rear HQ personnel. Philip's guns and the 5th Parachute Battalion held the Acropolis against all attacks, and later helped the brigade hold the centre of the city. Had they not done so until adequate military and political reinforcement arrived, Greece would not have been the only southeastern European country to escape suffering communist domination. Back home, my mother, for reasons she could not understand, was asked to serve on a Royal Commission on Population, the reason for which at a critical period of the war she could not understand either. Between sessions, there were some heated arguments on whether it was in fact right to back the government rather than ELAS, as left-wingers on the commission like Peggy Jay were urging. William Robison, the editor of the Glasgow Herald, was one member firmly backing the government's stand, as was my mother. Letters home from Philip described some of the atrocities and evil actions of ELAS, which Robison read with interest and asked to publish. Perhaps because they so clearly breached censorship rules, Philip declined to allow it. So Robison told Mother that if I wanted to write anything on my war, he would consider publishing it. Not only did he do so, but on my vacation from Oxford University terms, twice let me join his sub-editors and learn from other subs who instructed me, like Peregrine Worsthorne, meticulously correcting copy with a golden pen, or Alistair Hetherington, the future Guardian editor and later editor of the Manchester Guardian, which became the Guardian. So I owe my writing career to Philip in the war. We had little idea of what was happening in Yugoslavia or who had done what. The only impression we had was that Tito was a romantic figure with whom we had assisted to fight the Germans. So we just assumed that all the other jugs, as we called them, were baddies. Even so, I wrote an article about it in which I mentioned especially my feelings of sympathy as I watched a long procession of carts plodding towards the sunset, with even the horses looking dejected. They were probably Chetniks, had I known it, but I did quote a comment by their leader, General Mihailovich, which for me exactly described the situation around me. I was lost in the gale of the world. Only when we reached Klagenfurt did I realise the dangerous situation, with the town awash with partisans, a few scruffy Cossacks in German uniforms, others in assorted uniforms, and a few SS soldiers. First I had to find the billets. That was where I came on a small group of German SS sitting on a veranda. They had taken no notice of the order to disarm after the surrender on 2nd May, several days before the overall surrender in Europe. As I walked up to them, three or four ostentatiously clicked off the safety catches on their machine pistols. It then dawned on me that in the confusion, they could easily assuage their anger by shooting me and disappearing without problem in the seething confusion. So I broke the oppressive silence with, "My company is just behind. Please leave, as we will want this house." Then, with the odd tingle in my spine, I turned my back on the glowering faces and walked slowly to my jeep, where driver Crowhurst had sensibly started the engine. The billets I found were on the outskirts of the town, and I was focused on agreeing with the residents how many of us could be fitted in at each house. So it was indeed a case of shock, horror, surprise when I was summoned to an O group to learn that we had to stand too, with an imminent prospect of being attacked by Tito's men. Mentally and militarily, we were in no state for such action. This was mountain country, and the partisans were skilled guerrilla fighters in an environment where tanks would have been of no use. Mentally, we were appalled at the thought of fighting again. So we were mightily relieved and very grateful when we heard that Brigadier Lowe, later Lord Aldington, had negotiated the partisans' return back beyond their own border. In the gale of the world, such was the confusion that no word of the repatriation problems close by, borne by another part of the division, ever reached me 40 years later. we had no premonition about the disgraceful incident that then unfolded. 40 years later, when it was easy to concoct stories about her long past events, this led to the most famous libel trial of the last century, which stirred my memories and involved me in ways I have recorded, I then recorded. There were also, before I go on to consider that, there were also a couple of letters that I wrote home as the war in Italy was meant to have come to an end. In other words, on VI Day, Victory in Italy Day. What joy, we've made it at last. For a second time, a quarter of a million, or in this case double that, have surrendered to us. What has been particularly pleasing is that we have forced the surrender of such huge numbers here while the war is still going on elsewhere in Europe. As you know, when I was on leave, I was surprised to find most of the people with whom I talked did not even know about the war in Italy, because after D-Day, it rarely, if ever, got even a brief mention in the media. That was despite our successes and high casualties of over a quarter of a million. Totally ignored, too, was the major help we had given to the D-Day invasion, with over half a million German troops tied up here, including some of their best armoured and parachute divisions. Had they been available for the defence of Normandy, D-Day could well have been a disaster rather than the close-run success it was, since we could not have landed any more troops for the initial attack, as no more planes or ships were available. So perhaps we might actually manage to get a paragraph or two at last with this massive surrender to us, and I will try and write something tomorrow for Robison's Glasgow Herald. That letter followed and began, I have written this on Victory in Italy night, and it may be too out of date for Robison to use in the Glasgow Herald. Caption, the end in Italy. Tonight is Victory in Italy night. The end, when it came, was an anticlimax. Events in the past month had been such on such an epic scale that nothing new has the power to surprise or excite so much. Having had so often to endure hope deferred, that bitterest of experiences, the final realization of our hopes has left us unexpectedly flat and unemotional. Probably that was because there was nothing unexpected about it, after the past week or so, during which our war had moved with such speed and inexorable certainty to this end. So we had already accepted its inevitability. Passing the flag-decked towns, the cheering crowds, the droves of listless, unshaven prisoners, and for my company at least, the long silences of guns, had all told the same tale. Tonight, we merely have the chance to celebrate officially what we already celebrated mentally for several days of almost triumphant progress. Our true reward was not in the flowing wine, the tracer bullets and coloured Bofors guns and rockets lighting the night sky, or in the cheering and the singing, or the countryside around us ablaze with bonfires. It was in the easing of tension and the final relaxation of taut nerves, coupled with a great sense of achievement as a great army won its final victory in style. Since the build-up to this remarkable ultimate triumph has passed almost unnoticed back home, it is a special pleasure that the surrender of around half a million to us before the D-Day follow-up war is won should be worth a paragraph or two to mention our very different and very effective campaign. Later, I was to write for them my own view of the campaign, which ended. Of this last campaign, Churchill was to write in a letter to Alexander just before the surrender, that he wrote, let's just find the appropriate place. This was his message to Alexander on the 29th of April 1945. I rejoice in the magnificently planned and executed operations of the 15th Group of Armies, which are resulting in the complete destruction or capture of all the enemy forces south of the Alps. That great final battle in Italy will long stand out in history as one of the most famous episodes of the Second World War. That was probably a deserved compliment, but as a prophecy, it was one that was as wrong as it could be. We were remembered on Victory in Italy night, and indeed for a very few years, VI Day was also celebrated along with VE Day. Then, however, some clever clog at whoever was doing the organisation thought there would be a good wheeze to lump it in with Europe to save money, and so we disappeared entirely under the umbrella of Victory in Europe Day. But for us, the Italian campaign, with what is now said to be 300,000 casualties, and that we inflicted, though the defending side is usually expected to have fewer casualties, particularly when they have the sort of defences the Germans had, we inflicted 450,000 casualties on the Germans, apart from keeping 500,000 or more down in Italy rather than going to the assistance of against the D-Day landings. So we appreciated what Churchill had to say, but unfortunately for us, he could not have been more wrong in his prophecy. So with the war over, 42 years later, when it was very easy to concoct stories about long past events in very special circumstances, this led to the most famous libel trial of the last century, which stirred my memories and in minor ways involved me at both ends of the argument which led to the libel trial. I thus recorded the event.